Ed Schneider, and this is the session on a look at contemporary American culture. So if that's what you had in mind for this hour, you're in the right place. How many of you looked at yourself in the mirror this morning? Most of you did. Once in a while, at least, I think it's important for all of us to look in the mirror, because we use a mirror sort of to make sure that our hair is combed properly, or that we've done a decent job of shaving, or putting on lipstick, or make sure that our clothes look the way we want to. But in a more symbolic and a more profound sense, it is important from time to time, I think, that we hold a mirror to our lives to see who we are, where we are in relation to where we want to be and who we want to be. And this morning, I would like to take at least part of the time that we have together to try to hold a mirror to our culture, to our society, with the hope that we can consider together how the currents, or some of the currents, in contemporary American culture might relate to our ministry as Christian people. Obviously, we can't talk about everything in this hour, maybe not even some of the most important things, but I do want to take at least a part of this hour to lift up what I see to be some of the prevailing attitudes in our culture. Perhaps the most pervasive attitude, one about which a good deal has been written in recent years, has to do with a focus on oneself. I expected that to be blue, but it turned out to be blue. Christopher Lash has written about what he calls the culture of narcissism, painting a picture of the person who is caught up in this culture as self-absorbed, uninterested in the past or the future, and unable to subordinate desire to some higher social purposes. Daniel Yankelovich and Ruth Clark have written about college and non-college youth values based on some of the research that they did in the mid-70s. And they say this, quote, "On campus, student interest has shifted away from social reform and is now heavily focused on the self and its private vicissitudes. Today's college youth have little emotional commitment to changing society and are instead preoccupied with their own career planning and personal self-fulfillment," unquote. The last decade or so, decade and a half, has seen this strong emphasis on introspection in our society. The strong emphasis on self-fulfillment has sometimes been accompanied by a general withdrawal from the public and collective world. And perhaps the best evidence for this social phenomenon is just to stroll through any bookstore and observe the number of books that are devoted to getting what's mine at whatever cost to you may be necessary. This current emphasis on the realization of my potential can easily lead to a corresponding disregard or even lack of energy for assuming any kind of social responsibility. The self-fulfillment concept often implies a preoccupation with self at the expense of sacrificing oneself for family, for employer or community or even country. The emphasis then is on self-expression, creativity, self-development, and physical well-being. As Daniel Yankelovich put it in an article on new rules in American life in Psychology Today a couple of years ago now, an article that I'll refer to more than once in the course of my remarks this morning, he says, "In place of the self-denial ethic that once ruled American life, we now find people who refuse to deny themselves anything, not out of bottomless appetite, but on the strange moral principle that I have a duty to myself. According to this attitude, I myself am the object of my creative energies. I am my own success story, and my own work of art, unquote. He's described some of the pitfalls of this orientation. Let me quote him again. Quote, acting in the name of self-fulfillment, many people are startled to wake up one day and find themselves with a broken marriage, a wrong-headed career change, or simply a muddled state of mind about what life choices to make. And he goes on, people unwittingly bring a set of flawed psychological premises to the search for self-fulfillment. In particular, the premise that the human self is a hierarchy of inner needs and self-fulfillment an inner journey to discover them. This premise is rarely examined, even though it often leads people to defeat their goals and to end up isolated and anxious instead of fulfilled. Among the people I interviewed, he says, many truly committed self-fulfillment seekers focus so sharply on their own needs that instead of achieving the more intimate relationships they desire, they grow farther apart from others. In dwelling on their own needs, they discover that the inner journey brings loneliness and depression. They're caught in a debilitating contradiction. Their goal is to expand their lives by reaching beyond the self. But the strategy they employ constricts them, drawing them inward toward an ever-narrowing, closed-off I. People want to enlarge their choices, but seeking to keep all options open, they diminish them. Unquote. Now let me be clear that it is not my intention to condemn all interests in oneself. I believe that one can and one must speak about an appropriate care for oneself, even as a precondition for service to others. Much of what has grown out of this cultural attitude, such as a renewed interest in the care of the body and in health, can be understood, I think, in terms of proper stewardship of what God has entrusted to us. And I think we also need to recognize that the context for much of this emphasis upon the self is the highly impersonal and dehumanizing nature of the institutions in which we're forced to live so much of our lives, so that a focus upon oneself can be understood as a frantic, last-ditch assertion of our humanity. But nonetheless, the inadequacies of this attitude, I think, have to be of some concern to us as a Christian. A second attitude that I'd like to hold up, perhaps not unrelated to the first, is a pervasive ethical relativism. We'll find one work. There is a pervasive notion in our society that there are no absolute standards of right and wrong. Ethics is at most a matter of individual taste. And this ethical relativism has been spawned and fostered, I think, by pluralism, by the situation where many competing beliefs exist side by side. We no longer live in a kind of homogeneous community with a single and commonly accepted belief system throughout the community. We live in a society of competing voices, espousing various and conflicting systems of belief, understandings of reality, and values in relation to conduct. And out of this pluralistic confrontation of beliefs and values has developed what I think is a kind of superficial notion of tolerance, which reduces questions concerning ethics and conduct to simply a matter of personal preference. If there is a central ethical thread that runs throughout this context of ethical pluralism, it is that I'm not my brother's keeper. Anything goes so long as nobody gets hurt in the process. Coinciding, I think, with this pervasive ethical pluralism has been the erosion of the core public values of our society. Every society in history, in order to function, needs a commonly agreed upon core of values which sort of provide the glue that holds the society together. And it's no secret that lots of people in our society are concerned that our society is in fact becoming unglued because these core values and commitments are being eroded. William Meal, a professor at Yale University Divinity School, has referred to what he calls, quote, the useful myth that social value judgments in this nation are based upon a foundation of secular, self-evident truths, unquote. But of course, the myth is being exploded. Perhaps no issue has so exploded this myth in recent years as the debate, for instance, about public policy regarding abortion. There are no secular, self-evident truths to which the body politic can appeal in that kind of debate. Regardless of where one stands in that debate, there are value judgments which ultimately derive from some form of religious commitment. And we are discovering in this issue and in many others that there is then no way of avoiding an examination of the religious roots of our value judgments, even over here in the realm of public policy. A third attitude, which I think permeates our culture, has to do with uncertainty about technology. Uncertainty about technology. We entered the recent past in American society with a kind of optimistic assuredness about technology. We led the world with our technological know-how, and we believed that eventually all of our problems, or most of them, could be solved by technology. Technology had brought us a higher standard of living than anybody else in the world. When we begin to contemplate the rapid changes that technology has brought to our lives in just the last generation or two, it's truly overwhelming. Some of our grandparents, for instance, traveled by horse and buggy, and today we wing our way across the nation in a matter of just a few hours. They depended upon letters for personal communication and newspapers for public communication. Today we can make a telephone call anywhere in the world, and we get instant news through satellite coverage, television coverage of our communication. We have relied on that kind of rapid technological development to prolong our life and to increase the quality of our life. Think, for example, of modern medical equipment like the CAT scanner or radioactive diagnostic procedures or a kidney dialysis machine for prolonging life. Or consider the convenience of microwave ovens or air conditioning or electric heat. In two or three generations, we have seen improvements in all of these areas that have simply boggled our imagination. And we've sort of had the assurance that these advances would continue unabated. But in recent years, we have also begun to see the other side of that coin. We've seen that our higher standard of living has been purchased by incredible environmental pollution and ecological damage. We have depleted in a relatively few short years the fossil fuels which have taken millennia to develop. And even the current sort of oil glut that we are experiencing doesn't nullify that basic kind of condition. We've seen increases in cancer and other forms of illness caused by the byproducts of our industrial society. Perhaps most dramatically, we have seen medical gadgetry used to artificially prolong life at the expense of excruciating suffering for the person involved and added agony for family members. the technology of communication, which was designed, you know, to bring us closer together, and certainly does in terms of making the world, making world news coverage kind of instantaneous, also has the potential for driving us farther apart. Andrew Lippmann, who is a Massachusetts Institute of Technology researcher, worries that because electronics will bring nearly any kind of entertainment and information into our homes, that it will become increasingly difficult to attract people out of their homes. He says, when people can play chess with someone overseas or watch a ballet on a wall-sized screen, chances are they won't spend the gas or money and time to go out for entertainment. He says that the result could well be a splintered, less cohesive, more hibernated population and electorate, unquote. His concern reminded me of a clipping that I found a little while ago on our kitchen bulletin board at home, which says, one of today's riddles is how in a world growing smaller and a population growing larger, people can be drifting farther apart. In a similar vein, think of the ambiguous effects of television. While it obviously offers us many good things, it also means that family members now spend hours passively watching the tube rather than communicating with one another in creative and meaningful ways. Or consider the electronic games kids play these days, where instead of really playing with or against other kids, they match their wits against an electronic little creature created on the television screen. So we have become much more uncertain, I think, about the unqualified value of technology. We have begun to see that technology is a much more ambiguous kind of thing. The words of Charles Dickens, used to describe the French Revolution in A Tale of Two Cities, could now easily apply to our assessment of technology. He said, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. We have begun to ask ourselves whether we have the moral wisdom to match the rapid advances that we have been making in technology. We've begun to see that technology is not some unqualified good, that we will need to assess and control the various technologies that develop for our use. Many have now come to realize that not everything, in other words, that can be done, should be done. Certainly in no single area has the dark side of technology been so evident as in the development of nuclear energy. The threat of nuclear holocaust must, I think, be understood as another of those realities that simply pervade our contemporary culture. In the long history of humankind, only those who have grown up since the Second World War have lived their lives with the possibility and the threat of nuclear annihilation. Until now, most of the world's population has lived sort of with the notion of war as a way of life. Our parents and grandparents fought in global conflicts which they believed were just causes. But the notion of total war has become obsolete in our generation. World War II was the last total war which this world will see until the final conflagration. Let me say that once more. World War II was the last total war which this world will ever see until the final conflagration. Young people today realize that our civilization and indeed our entire world could be destroyed in a matter of minutes or hours. They observe an insane arms race by our nation and by our adversary. And in the face of this knowledge, hope for the future has really become a precious commodity. Several years ago, some surveys indicated that only a minority of young people expected to die a natural death. Most thought that they would die in a nuclear holocaust. That's the horrible reality with which we must deal in working, for instance, with today's youth. And it's a reminder to us, I think, that the cause of peace is really the number one ethical issue with which we have to deal in our time. Another set of critical issues, especially for young people in our culture, issues now of a very different sort, center around attitudes toward marriage and the family. We've heard a good deal in recent years about changes in marriage and family life, and I think it's sometimes difficult to assess just how radical some of these changes really are. But at least there are certain broad outlines that we can kind of discern. Yankelevich points out that while marriage was taken for granted a generation ago, that's no longer the case today. Nor is it assumed that people once married will expect to stay married. He says, quote, "The study I conducted in the late 50s, that's now 25 years ago, among single and married women in their teens and early 20s, demonstrated the strength back then of marriage norms. All the single women I interviewed assumed they would marry and have children. The married women who did not yet have children all stated they planned to have them. Most wanted 3 or 4 children or more. The mothers in the study were all married, and each pronounced herself thoroughly satisfied with being a mother. Although several of the young mothers admitted that they'd become pregnant without intending to, none of them felt comfortable saying outright that she did not want to have a child. Today, marriage and parenthood are rarely viewed as necessary, and people who do not choose these roles are no longer considered social deviants. Furthermore," he continues, "and also in sharp contrast to the past, it has become normal to think of marriage as not being permanent. When an NBC Associated Press poll asked Americans in 1978 whether they thought most couples getting married today expect to remain married for the rest of their lives, a 60% majority said no." My own children report that in many of their classes in school, children from two-parent homes are in a distinct minority. The majority of kids come from single-parent homes or homes that have been broken by divorce or separation. Perhaps not unrelated to this is another growing phenomenon of young people living together without marriage. It's estimated that the number of such unmarried couples living together has more than doubled between 1960 and 1977. If you want the figures, he says, from 439,000 to 957,000. It's not, of course, that these young people don't ever intend to marry. In fact, most pastors testify to the increasing number of those coming to be married who have been known to be living together. This is certainly an issue where the church, I think, has not addressed the issue as forthrightly as we must. Standards relating to premarital sex have apparently changed rather rapidly in our culture. As recently as 1967, Yankelevich found that 85% of the parents now, of college-age youths, condemned all premarital sex as morally wrong. Now, 63% of the parents condone it, believing that if two people love each other, there's nothing wrong with having sexual relations. This suggests, to me at least, that, among other things, that the very meaning of sex has changed for some people. And that, in turn, I think, means that those of us who work with young people in the context of the church must do more than simply repeat the traditional prohibitions and must find ways to talk meaningfully about the core meanings of sexual intercourse. Alongside these changes, of course, have come some other changes with respect to the expectations of men and women, also with regard to the family. Yankelevich points out that, quote, changing norms of what a woman is supposed to do as a wife and mother and what a man is supposed to do as a husband and father are transforming the institutions of the workplace and the family. Probably no set of shifting norms carries greater significance for the culture, he says. A majority of women, for instance, now work outside the home. And yet that, again, is not without two sides of the coin sort of thing. A recent survey conducted by General Mills suggests that a majority of women, as well as men, consider such work to have more negative than positive impact on school-age children when they are present. And yet, the economic pinch, which many families now feel in relation to the current economic situation, in addition to the desire of many women for the satisfactions of a career, would seem to indicate that as time goes on, ever greater percentages of women will be employed outside the home. And that means, I'm speaking here of mothers of children. And the stresses, then, which accompany such employment will be part of what will have to be reckoned with in our daily lives. A number of changes that I've already described have contributed, I think, also to a changing attitude toward work in our culture. An older view of work was that work always paid off, leading to an ever-increasing standard of living. One's worth was measured by one's work, and one's work was valued in accordance with what it could do for you in terms of providing for your family. If work was uninteresting or unfulfilling, that was probably too bad, but that was secondary. The primary expectation was to earn a living, with the promise that that standard of living would continue to improve as one moved up the ladder of success. But that attitude has changed in recent years. Now the primary expectation for many is that work should be interesting and fulfilling. Hierarchical and authoritarian work arrangements are being challenged. People assert the right to participate in decisions that affect their work. In short, work is expected to be interesting as well as to pay well. Now, when those expectations clash with the realities of a difficult economic period, as we have been going through, then the result is often frustration and disappointment and a new word, stress. Closely connected with this changed attitude toward work is a reexamination, I think, of lifestyle going on in our culture. A movement towards simpler lifestyles has been developing in places, as we know, in the U.S. in recent years. While developing in different forms and with varying levels of involvement, there are certain general characteristics of the movement that I think we can observe. Those involved in the movement seek to avoid wasteful and thoughtless consumption and to live a more simple, frugal manner. Emphasis is placed upon needs rather than upon wants. If you've been around Holden for half a day, you begin to understand something of what this movement is about. There's concern that products ought to be energy-saving, functionally healthy, non-polluting, durable, repairable, recyclable. The movement represents a kind of value shift away from material satisfaction and towards self-reliance and living in greater harmony with the environment, away from quantity of production and toward quality of life. The movement has been labeled voluntary simplicity in order to distinguish it from the austere life of enforced poverty. In contrast to a romantic longing for the simple rustic life, this movement represents a response to fundamental, I think, and interconnected concerns of the modern world. Those concerns are, first of all, the energy crisis, which forces a reexamination of our ways of using scarce fossil fuels. Secondly, environmental strains, which prompt consideration of sort of the long-term costs of the way we live in terms of the ability of the natural environment to sustain the kind of life that we want for ourselves and for future generations. Thirdly, a concern for global justice, which demands that we take a look at our own part in perpetuating injustice or promoting a better life for the rest of the world's people. And fourthly, patterns of consumption and waste, which lead us to question the material values of our society. While the extent and the duration of this movement toward a simpler lifestyle, I think, is still uncertain, the movement focuses certain issues that have implications for us in Christian living. It underscores, first of all, the seriousness of what we have traditionally called Christian stewardship. It reminds us of our need to be responsible managers of the creation that has been entrusted to us by God. Perhaps most fundamentally, the movement prompts us to re-examine our own basic self-understanding. Does ever-increasing production and consumption represent, finally, for us, an idolatrous quest for power and for security in a changing world? Have we substituted manipulation of persons and things for a more positive way of relating? Have we come to place unlimited faith in technological progress to save us from our destructive follies and in our use of the Earth's resources? Does our style of life represent an escape from our sense of lostness and our sense of futility in a world that we perceive to be without meaning and destined, finally, for death? Underneath this re-examination of lifestyle, and I think indeed underneath all of the other changes that I've described, there is, I think, a renewed quest for meaning. I think that underneath all of the ferment that we may see going around us in our culture, there is this relentless quest, search for meaning. It may once have been the case that meanings were more easily identified in our culture. The substance of the culture, in other words, might have been more easily agreed upon by people living in that culture. Some of the places where people have looked for meaning in recent years have been discovered to be dead ends. Yankelevich believes, for example, that after all of the time that we've spent in the last decade or decade and a half focusing upon oneself, that there are now bits of evidence that American culture is evolving toward a new ethic of commitment. But the object of that commitment, I contend, will depend, finally, upon where people find meaning. The question of meaning, I would contend, is the central religious question of our time. The question of meaning is finally the question of God, of that which is ultimate, of that upon which I can finally stake my life. It is the function of religious belief to provide a meaning system which enables a person to bring order out of the chaos of life. And therefore, I think that underneath all of the ferment that we may discover in our society, We need to search or push always toward that core question of meaning. Because I think it's in response to that question that the gospel will begin to make any sense. Well, so far from my speech. Now it's open for questions, retorts. Yes, Ruth.
It's an interesting, your last thesis is an interesting observation to me. I thought about this recently at a gay dinner party at which the question came up in conversation, what do you believe in? And this was a gathering of a couple who have a Roman Catholic background and another couple that were Episcopalian, and he was an Episcopal priest. And I was nonplussed at the responses that the question got, because it was the, I believe in America, I believe in my country, I believe in my wife, I believe in family, I believe in myself. There were just responses that I was really amazed at, because they weren't ultimate responses in my thinking at all. And just didn't help me conceive of believing, of considering believing without it being an ultimate kind of question.
The question, I suppose, is whether for those persons, perhaps some of those beliefs function as ultimates. In other words, I would be my thesis that everybody is religious. By definition, people are religious because they have something ultimate in which they place their faith. It may be more or less defined, and it may be more or less connected with what we, in traditional terms, have pointed to as the ultimate. But it functions in some way for them as that which is ultimate. It's the object of their faith, finally. And so I would contend that that's their religious belief.
Perhaps the question should have been, what is your faith, instead of what do you believe in? Because I think there's quite a difference. I think we all believe in lots of things, but your faith is something else again. Your ultimate faith, if that's the question, I should think.
And you're using that distinction between belief and faith to try to point us beyond some of the, what Ruth is calling perhaps secondary beliefs toward something which is more.
That's right. You don't ask a person what his religion is, I don't think, because I think religion is an all-encompassing term. I think you ask a person if you want to find out where they're going, ultimately, you ask them about their faith.
Yeah.
And I think there are distinctions here, at least where I come from.
Some of it, of course, is the terminology we become comfortable with. Yeah. Aubrey.
I think as a follow on to that comment, Carl Jung was asked if he believed. He said, no, I know, which I thought was an interesting addition to the word faith. The other thing that I was thinking about as you were speaking was this last quest. It seems to me that the quest for meaning becomes primarily a motivator to drive us toward the solution of all these problems. And then it comes out, what does the motivator bring us to? Or bring you to thinking that, well, in order to do something about it, that is what we've been talking about. What are we going to do about all these problems, the nuclear energy and the uncertainty of technology and so forth? We need a leader. We've always depended on some great leadership. And in these times, leadership to be effective has to be represented by more than one person. We no longer have two people like Jesus Christ establish a tremendous whole lifestyle of most people. So it comes back to the church. Maybe within the church, we take certain elements of organization, like the synod, whom you are most involved. And I'm sure that the Senate, if it could come to a realization of what were the best ways to attack the problem, not just to say we're against nuclear energy, but to find out what is the problem of the technological uncertainty, the basic focus on self, and all of these things, if the church and its leadership and wisdom could get at the direction to go to solve these problems, and then take leadership in directing this whole vast, great religious group. I think Holden is doing a great thing, and certainly one part of the ecological environmental thing. I mean, it's tremendous. And I think you have more Holdens in these other disciplines.
You raise an interesting point, I think, in connection with all of that, and that's the question of leadership and the kind of culture in which we live. A culture which is so pluralistic, it's comprised of people with such diverse views in terms of that which is finally meaningful to them, makes leadership extremely difficult at the same time as it becomes extremely necessary, isn't it? Somehow, it would seem to me that it would be the function of a leader, and I'm not speaking here not now just in what we traditionally may have called religious context, but more generally, it would be the function of a leader to catch a vision of meaning out of all of this, and then galvanize people behind that vision. And I think because of the of this pluralistic situation in which we live, that's been hard to have happen. Yes, Ron?
I think one and two really are a dilemma. The fact that we now focus so much on ourselves is partly the church's fault.
Yes.
Because I remember coming from the mission field in the 60s and reading an awful lot of books put out by the church and church leaders saying we have to care for ourselves. And so
we bought into that one pretty heavily.
The church often take something and runs with it like a bandit. Number two, I see also the church is in the forefront of leading to the loss of absolutes and ethical and other things and causing us to be more open. Now, our problem is not to say, let's go back to self-denial. Our problem is not to say, let's go back to absolutism. I don't want to be back there.
Right.
Our problem as Christian people is to decide, how do we walk that narrow line? And none of us has the right answer today as far as I've read. Not a one of us knows the right balance between absolutism, standards that remain forever, and those that we have to be open with and tolerate. And how do we, in this culture, with our backgrounds, make those hard ways of changing the way we emphasize and choose and live? I don't have the answer.
You've introduced my speech for tomorrow.
Oh, sorry.
I spent my life dealing with things. Things that you build, stack, block, on top of each other, you know, bricks and mortar, whatever. Technical kind of background. And in that background, as opposed to a teaching, educating type of thing where you talk a lot. In my case, when the dam starts to break, you've got to do something. And if something doesn't happen one way, we have to fix it and do another. And so anytime you come to a problem, you can't just sit back and talk about what would be nice to do or what mistakes you made. You have to fix it. And so if we can come to a point of understanding this leadership I'm speaking of, saying, okay, we're going to have to do a lot of thinking considering and maybe talking with each other, and then we'll not always get the right answer, not always go the right direction, but we have to do something. If we just talk about it, we're going to go along just like we did for the atomic energy issue first came up. They first exploded the bomb in Japan, And they said, gee, this has great potential for industrial use. We're going to have warmer housing with a piece of the size of a walnut. It's got great potential. And other people at the same time, I remember clearly, say, now wait a minute. We do not have the social responsibility. We do not have the humanistic development to handle this great technological advancement. Let's take it easy. A lot of discussion at that time about that. It's like now we're talking about what we do about the problem we have. But we weren't able at that time to put together a means to slow this thing down to renew what we're, where we're going. And many of our nuclear problems now, which I'm somewhat familiar with, have come about because the great sponsor of the energy program, the United States government, the agencies, they encouraged everyone who to us all to go ahead and develop these great plants. They didn't know, they still haven't found out all the best safe ways to protect these. So we've gotten ourselves going to this trap. Now, we have to get out of it. So to get out of the trap, we have to take some steps, make some decisions, and then do something. We can't just know.
You're saying wringing our hands is not enough.
Not enough.
Yeah. I just point out they've talked more before they did
it
instead of doing
them
so fast.
That's right.
We
didn't put our
actions
for our mouth.
This relates, I read an interesting news item that the Republican Party for the coming campaign has decided that half of the budget would be developing Pepsi-Cola type commercials showing people that are rich, happy, and healthy, and then fight the Pepsi and then connect Reagan at the end. You know, and it just fits into the narcissism. I think we have a party in this leadership that wants is going to try to win.
Sounds like Madison Avenue.
It's very interesting.
Yeah.
I guess I don't take such a negative view of our society right now. I kind of see our society coming out of this focus on one, on ourselves, and maybe shifting toward back of the caring and looking at the world around us. I was at a mini course that I took this past year on childbearing, and I think that that's the area of women and there's, I think I was one of two guys in this class anyway. We came to the conclusion that our society is maybe coming in a circle in that one area at least, where a number of years ago it was in vogue for the women to be career oriented, and we still see a lot of that, and that's fine. But we also see that a lot of people are going back to the old traditional things where women want to have families and want to have families, and I think that's good for our society.
Let me just, before I pick up a comment, let me say thank you for that comment. A couple of things, at least one. Two things came to mind, not one of them's gone. But I think that one of the things I tried to indicate is that there are mixed signals going on, I think, in our culture. Yankelovich, for instance, says that we're moving again towards some kind of an ethic of commitment. It's not quite clear how where that's going, but that is a shift away from some of the stark emphasis on self, as we've seen a decade or so ago. Secondly, and most importantly, I hope not to leave the impression through the remarks that I've given that I've somehow taken a negative view toward all of this stuff. What I want to suggest is that there is an ambiguity, an ambivalence with respect to all of these things, which can be, you know, it depends on how we use them. Technology is a perfect example, of course. Technology is a marvelous gift, but the better the gift, the more potential there is also for abuse. And when we abuse something, then the dehumanizing potential is all the more evident. And if we hook that up finally with our vision of what meaning there ought to be in life, we have a better chance of moving all of these things in a direction that's positive rather than negative.
It's my impression that in studies of past culture, that this is one thing that is so very different now from preceding cultures is this vast ambiguity in all areas of our life. When you look at this and you say, this all adds up to ambiguity, a lot of dilemmas that are set up. And this was not quite as pronounced, in my impression, as it is now.
And why was that the case? Why was that the case? Why was life not so ambiguous? In some ways, life was very ambiguous for our grandparents and great-grandparents as well. But in other ways, it was obviously not as ambiguous. Why was that the case? They didn't move around so much. They lived in a community that tended to have pretty much the same values. And even the people who flaunted the values, who lived in opposition to them, nonetheless accepted them in a certain sense. They knew that they were flaunting them. They accepted them in the breaking.
Didn't have so many problems.
And it was a simpler kind of world, technologically again, such.
I'm a little uncomfortable saying that the ethical relativism comes from the pluralism. I'm wondering if there aren't other reasons for it. I mean, it seems to me that we do live in a pluralistic society as something that we need to accept and value those differences. But it just makes me a little uncomfortable because then we can say if the pluralism causes it, then let's
do away with pluralism. Yeah. I don't want to say that. But I would strongly contend that pluralism is perhaps the precipitating factor for the relativism. And I think an example of that, and this differs obviously, the example would differ, but for many small communities in the Midwest, for instance, where there is a fairly homogeneous value system, and a young person comes up through high school and goes to the university and meets people who come from altogether different situations, and discover that lo and behold, here is somebody who is really a likable person and has a very different value system from what I've learned, and all of a sudden that you begin then to question your own system. And one of the ways of dealing with that is what I call a superficial tolerance, a tolerance that simply says it doesn't really matter, you know, everybody. So that's the relativism. That's different. There's a healthy tolerance too.
I guess that's really the source of the admonition to judge not, because there's something in our nature that wants to say that the way I am is so okay and the principles and the frame that I hold is so comfortable for me that it really should be everybody's. And it's then that leads us to, instead of celebrating the variety and respecting the variety and saying, you know, that too can be part of God's good creation. There's something else that wants to say, no, my way is really the way. And I think that it's a healthy thing that we respect and honor the variety and celebrate the variety. And that we should remember then that judge not is telling us, look, you know, you must be the Lord's being that you are in your way, and without insisting that that someone else the other way. I think the variety of personality types in it, within this one room, for instance, is evidence of that.
Yeah, I would just contend that it doesn't necessarily need to be one way or the other. There is, on the one hand, the sort of self-righteous point of view that does, as you say, insist that everyone should have the same values that I have. That's one extreme. And the other extreme, I think, is this superficial tolerance that says whatever anybody believes is okay. I'm okay, you're okay, you know. I think that there is a way down the middle that says I can commit myself to certain values which I accept as being fundamentally true, and if true for me, then fundamentally true for the universe, at the same time respecting the view of those who hold to some different view.
But what about the matter of judging and judge not on a subject that is obviously harmful to the other person? So you say, I will not judge you even though you're destroying yourself. I have many questions, concerns about this. There are any things that are happening, say, in the Mideast. How can I judge what I think the Israelis are doing when I think they're committing suicide by what they're doing? And so, I mean, I have a hard time saying, do not judge or judge.
Yes, I have. That's why I have trouble interpreting those words of Jesus, because I don't want it to be this superficial way of saying it.
I don't think it's going to be all inclusive.
I think it refers more to an attitude of self-righteous insistence upon right. Our time is up. We'll take time for just one more comment or question over here, and then we've got to stop.
I think in terms of the judgment issue, for me, it comes down to being able to say that yes, I agree with you on this. I flatly disagree with you on this other issue. But I can still, I mean, that disagreement doesn't have to pervade into the whole relationship. I mean, I can still disagree with you and be your friend.
Yeah.
You know, without accepting what you say, but without pushing you away either.
You can respect someone without necessarily agreeing. Yeah, as a person. Yeah. Okay, our time has passed up. Something like this we'll do tomorrow when we talk about making decisions.